This AgriTalk podcast is brought to you by Acuron corn herbicide from Syngenta, which delivers 5 to 15 more bushels an acre than any other herbicide. Acuron is a restricted-use pesticide. Acuron Yield Advantage range is based on 2016 Syngenta and university trials. You probably already know that there are currently over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage. If you're a farmer, that gives you over 2 billion really good reasons to tell your legislators and friends to support ethanol. Learn more at poet.com/ag.
Grain markets up again Tuesday morning. Soybean futures climbing 20 cents on front month contracts. Corn's up 5. The harvest rally seems to be continuing. What will trade look like in the next 4 years? And we'll have an announcement about sustainability from the American Farm Bureau and a whole host of others. All that and more today on AgriTalk.
Live from Turn It Up Tuesday via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning we begin with Nassim Fassell from Holland and Knight. Then it's on to Andrew Walmsley, Director of Congressional Relations from the American Farm Bureau Federation. Then we'll talk with Matt Plitt, Executive VP from Valent, and Aiden Riley, co-founder of the FarmLink Project. And right after the news, Annalisa Laca from Farm Journal's Milk. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson, and now, filling in for Chip, the second most handsome man in Farm Journal's stable of broadcasters, Clinton Griffiths! How you doing, buddy boy?
Pretty good. We're pretty hard up here for that list. Notice there's no calendar that's come out.
Well, yeah, and there's no third place either. It's just after that, it just drops off sharply.
It just falls off sharply. Yeah, well, it's a pretty low bar. And that's fine. That's fine. I'm happy to sit in the chair today for Chip Flory, who is out on some much-needed R&R. Of course, like it's been for the last 2.5 years, Davis, there's just a plethora of things to talk about. There's no shortage.
Absolutely. And some of this, you know, we kind of joke around sometimes, especially on the stimulus package. You know, there's really no new story to report there. There's always something to report even on that. Even if the news doesn't change, we find ways to report on that.
I know. I call it, we're in this kind of super news cycle, and it's been going on for the last 2.5 years. At some point, I fully expect things to get real quiet. Now, maybe they won't, but I expect us to hit, you know, come down off the wave we're riding and go into this kind of the doldrums of news, as they call it, where we're reporting, you know, things that, you know, otherwise would put your grandmother to sleep after Thanksgiving dinner. So, you know, that's what I fully expect. We haven't gotten there yet. So we'll have to keep watching the waves crash on the shore.
If that happens, we're out of a job, Clinton. What are we going to do then? No other skills than this. I'm sure you've got other things you could do. You could probably pursue your major league pitching career, you know.
Hey, you're pretty good on the spoons. There's a chance. Well, I mean, you might be able to move to Nashville and really tear it up with the spoons.
Not enough spoons players in the world these days,
right.
I tell you.
More cowbell. Hey, what do we got going for the news?
Well, quickly, let's look at highlights from USDA's crop condition report from the weekend of November 15. Corn is 95% harvested now, Clinton. Soybeans, 96% harvested. Cotton, 69% harvested. Winter wheat, 96% planted. 85% emerged. 46% rated good to excellent. Swift harvest progress this year. So we got corn at 95% done, soybeans 96% done, baby. We're all but wrapped up here.
Pretty much. Once we kind of hit those numbers, it's just the stragglers. You know, we're just kind of picking up fields that are just still standing, things we haven't gotten to, maybe some trouble spots out there. So we've all but wrapped up this. And we've been pretty fortunate, right? We've had a few winter storms that have moved through to slow us down in a few places. But overall, this harvest season, you know, a lot of folks are going to be sitting down for Thanksgiving, being able to, you know, not feel guilty about having a meal.
Yep, it'll be nice. Well, members of the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries and Allies, that's OPEC, slashed production by a historic 9.7 million barrels in May to boost oil prices as COVID-19 shredded demand. Producers planned to increase the flow gradually as cars returned to roads and more planes took flight. However, the recent surge in COVID cases is again tempering oil demand. Last week, OPEC lowered its expectations for demand in 2020 to about 10% below the level last year. Now, today's meeting of the Joint Ministerial Monitoring Committee cannot adjust OPEC's targets for production, but it can make recommendations ahead of a bigger meeting at the end of the month. And it could be a an oil market rodeo if they start making recommendations for the end of the month.
Well, and I think we are going to see some adjustments. You know, like I said yesterday, our plans have changed for Thanksgiving. I know a lot of people's plans have changed. We're going to see a lot less travel. And that just, it is what it is. And so that means less fuel demand. And it's not just here. It's around the world. And so I fully expect to see this fuel problem, which is a problem, right, for our ethanol demand to continue. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what gas prices are where you live here in northern Indiana. It was $1.78 yesterday.
Yeah, we're about there here too. Well, the discovery of bird flu on another German farm will see that country slaughter up to 70,000 birds as a response. Denmark ordered the cull of 25,000 chickens after a find on a farm there. Other detections have been found in France, the Netherlands, and Britain. This will continue to build trade disruptions for the poultry exports in these countries to destinations outside the European Union. Domestically, President-elect Joe Biden will provide more detail on his trade policy once he assumes office. But on Monday, he said he told world leaders that labor unions and environmentalists will be, quote, at the table when he's negotiating any new trade deals. Asked to comment about the Sunday signed Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, Biden said it was premature to discuss the RCEP. However, he noted we need to be aligned with the other democracies so that we can set the rules of the road instead of having China and others dictate the outcome.
Mm. Yep, we'll continue to follow that. In fact, we'll be talking trade here with Nassim Fussell with Holland and Knight. She's got a great resume in working on trade and hopefully can give us an idea of what the next 4 years look like, and so we can try to get some ideas about trade moving forward. Appreciate it, Davis.
Excellent.
Thank you so much.
You betcha.
Let's jump over with Annalisa Laca, editor of Farm Journal's Milk. Hey, welcome back. Glad to have you back with us here on AgriTalk.
Hey, thanks, Clinton. It's good to be back.
Now, there's quite a bit going on in dairy. Obviously, we've been following along through all of this COVID issues, things happening this year. It's been quite the roller coaster. Talk to me a little bit about some of the safety net programs right now, because there's a sign-up coming up, isn't there?
Yeah, so the Dairy Margin Coverage Program is open for enrollment, and the sign-up period ends December 11th, and so we're really encouraging farmers to take a look at that. One thing that happened this year is that farmers, you know, the outlook for 2020 was much better than what it started the year to be. And so farmers who did not enroll in the Dairy Margin Coverage Program took a hit in the first quarter when you know, COVID really started. And since then, the market's recovered to quite a large extent, but still don't know what's going to happen next year. And there's still a lot of questions in terms of restaurant demand should COVID continue to you know, I think by all measures, we can say it's spreading rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
If that continues, restaurant demand will continue to be an issue for the dairy industry.
Yeah, yesterday we talked about it. It had taken about 6 days to add another million cases to the U.S. total, now sitting somewhere around 11 million cases in all since March or February, March. Hey, talk to me a little bit about some of these the COVID rules on dairy farms, because that's something that we fully expect to be trickling down soon.
Yeah, so right now the rules in place to keep employees safe are by a state-by-state mandate. They're being distributed by governors. So you see in some places like California, there are mask mandates for businesses with a certain number of employees or more. But we expect the Biden administration to, you know, in one of their first efforts to help combat the coronavirus, we expect them to put in some mandatory workplace safety measures for all employers. And it'll be interesting to see what happens, because obviously the Republicans and the Senate have been pushing for some liability protection for employers. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
All right. Well, we'll continue to follow along. Annalisa Laca, the editor of Farm Journal's Milk, thank you so much. Good to talk to you again. We've missed you. Hope you're doing well. And we'll talk to you again soon. Hey, stick with us. Coming up next, we're going to talk about trade and what the future may look like. We'll be right back with more AgriTalk.
With so many corn herbicides on the market today, it can be really difficult to choose which one is right for you. I'm joined today by Steve Gomm. He is corn herbicide product lead with Syngenta. Steve, what factors are most important to consider in choosing the right corn herbicide?
Well, you want to treat this decision like any financial investment, because that's exactly what it is, an investment in your farm. Start with a thorough evaluation of your herbicide options and how they align with your goals before making that purchase decision. If your goal is to maximize yield potential, you'll need to choose a herbicide that can help you do that, as not all herbicides can do that.
Yeah, that's right. So when we're doing this evaluation, what are the key factors to consider?
Well, obviously, input cost may be a factor, but growers should consider the spectrum of weeds to control, the length of residual, application flexibility, and the potential return on investment. They can ask themselves three key questions. Will the program be efficient? Does the program make financial sense? And are the herbicide brands proven and reputable?
Yeah, excellent checklist there. So which corn herbicide checks all of those boxes?
Well, going back to those three key considerations, Acuron herbicide is the only one that unlocks that corn's full yield potential. So it has the longest lasting residual to help fully protect yield potential and minimize the weed seed bank for next year's crop. Syngenta and University trials have shown Acuron out yields competitors by 5 to 15 bushels an acre. And lastly, Syngenta stands behind its products and has multiple resources available to help answer any questions or concerns a grower or retailer might have.
All right. Check, check, and check. Thank you, Steve. That was Steve Gomm. He is the corn herbicide product lead with Syngenta, talking to us about what to consider when selecting your corn herbicides for 2021. To find out what an extra 5 to 15 bushels per acre with Acuron corn herbicide could mean for your revenue potential, try Syngenta's online calculator at findmorebushels.com or talk to your local Syngenta retailer. Acuron is a restricted-use pesticide. Acuron yield advantage range is based on 2016 Syngenta and university trials. Right now, there are over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage just waiting to solve the world's most pressing issues like climate change. That's a lot of corn. Exports are unreliable and have been flat for 30 years. So how do we use all this corn right here in the U.S.? POET is working hard to achieve nationwide E15, which will generate the demand necessary to use up ever-increasing corn yields, increasing the amount of ethanol in the nation's fuel supply from 10% to 15% would result in a market of almost 2 billion bushels of new corn demand each year. That's the same as doubling exports, and that's 2 billion really good reasons to tell your legislators and friends to support higher blends of ethanol. It's time for farmers to unify around E15. Biofuels like ethanol are the key to successful agriculture, and successful agriculture will change the world. Learn more about what you can do to support nationwide E15 at poet.com/ag.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Bayer Plus Rewards, helping make every part of your season more rewarding.
Hey, welcome back to
Starling. Agent Starling reporting for duty, Clinton.
What's happening? Oh, my gosh.
I can never just hear this song in its own context ever again. Big Apple knows that, too. He's trying to give me the creeps first thing on a Tuesday morning. I'm not having it, Joe.
Oh, my gosh. I don't even know where I am right now. What world are we living in? All right. Hey, let's talk a little bit about trade. Private exporters this morning reporting to the USDA that export sales of 195,000 metric tons of corn for delivery to Mexico during the 2020-2021 marketing year. We continue to kind of, make some sales. We continue to see those numbers tick up, and that's good news out there. That demand is really pulling along on prices. Here to kind of help us, set the stage for where we are and what to expect, we are bringing in Nassim Fussell. She's with Holland and Knight. And Nassim, I want you to start by just giving folks tell a little bit about yourself and your work history, because it's a pretty impressive resume.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me. And it's very kind of you to say. I've had a very blessed career. I have been very lucky to work for some very, very wonderful individuals in the government. Most recently, I was the Chief International Trade Counsel for Senator Grassley, as he is chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and it was in his role as chairman that I worked for him as chief trade counsel. Prior to that, I worked for former Chairman Hatch And I also spent some time as trade counsel to the House Committee on Ways and Means, where we also had jurisdiction over trade and ag trade issues. There I worked for Chairman Camp, Chairman Ryan, and Chairman Brady. So really had a wonderful Hill career, and inevitably agriculture featured prominently in the work that I did there. And so, as you noted, I am now with Holland & Knight in their Washington office as a partner.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I want to kind of open this up and ask you just some different trade questions. What's your overall opinion of where we sit with this phase one trade deal with China? We have seen some good demand there. Of course, we're still waiting on shipments to leave our shores.
That's right. Well, you know, I'd say by far ag has been the biggest beneficiary of this phase one trade deal. And I'm going to refer now to the information put out by USDA and USTR just about 3 weeks ago now, laying out where we are. At that point, about 3 weeks ago, October 23rd, they reported that China had implemented at least 50 of the 57 technical commitments under the Phase 1 agreement.
I think that's really important. And I don't know. I mean, we're counting bushels and sales a lot, but those 50 out of 57, those technical requirement things, that seems like a very important part of this entire conversation.
Yes, it is. And I think the reason for that is that, you know, a lot of focus, understandably so, given the incredible importance of it, has been on the purchases. But the technical commitments, while they may not have covered every single issue covered in USTR's 2018 report that targeted the many problems we're facing with China, most prominently the intellectual property problem, many of these technical commitments made in the Phase 1 agreement are very beneficial to the U.S. ag industry in particular. I think that is the real bright spot of this Phase 1 agreement. And to be in October and to have had this many of these commitments achieved already, I think, is quite notable. But on the purchases, to date, China, well, as of late October, they had purchased over $23 billion in ag products, which is approximately 70% of the target under the Phase 1 agreement. A couple of beneficiaries in particular of these purchases are corn, soybeans, pork, beef, but also pet food, alfalfa, pecans, peanuts, and prepared foods. And there's more coming. You know, I think it's important to remember that we have several weeks still left in the year, and there is still time for purchases to be made. I know some are on water. So we're going to face inevitable headwinds. We're in a tough time. Both economies are not quite where anyone wants them to be. But, you know, with the pandemic, that will continue to present hurdles into 2021. But considering all of this, you know, I think it's been a fairly positive outcome to date.
Do you think that we, depending on what happens administration-wise, do you foresee that we renegotiate? I mean, there has been some mentions that China may want to renegotiate with the Biden administration. Do you see that happening? Is that a possibility at this point, or do we expect this to remain in force?
That is a great question. It is the million-dollar question. I fully expect that the Biden administration is going to come in and take a very deep look at this relationship. They've made that abundantly clear. Where I think they are going to likely focus rather than undoing phase one will be to see how they can strategically address the remaining issues, the issues that were core and central to that 2018 report issued by USTR. Some of these most prominent issues are, you know, forced technology transfer and industrial subsidies. These are issues that absolutely must be addressed, that there's broad bipartisan support for addressing. my expectation is that the Biden administration is going to look closely at these issues and how we can move forward there. You know, there is an opportunity to utilize what is on the table now with regard to tariffs as potentially some leverage in getting further in addressing some of those issues. There's a lot of questions about whether they may be interested in rolling back some of the tariffs that the Trump administration has imposed. I don't expect them to do that quickly at all. However, I do see those as a potential tool for leverage to utilize as a way to focus on these other core issues that, by and large, bipartisan support exists to tackle.
Yeah. And what do you think happens at the USTR office? Could Lighthizer stay on?
I don't think so. I mean, he could, but I certainly haven't heard any whispering of He has developed very, very solid relationships with both Republican and Democrat members of Congress. You know, he has accomplished a lot during his time as USTR. You know, I think a lot will depend on the Biden administration's desire to keep him on, which I have not heard, but similarly, his desire to stay on, right. Which, again, I have not heard.
Yeah, you know, part of the conversation, I think, will be around, will there be a different strategy? Like before, you know, things like CFTPP, you know, China just signing this RCEP trade agreement, you know, will there be these multilateral, multi-country agreements? Do you think we return to something like that in the next 4 years?
The Biden camp has talked a lot about a return to multilateralism and forging stronger ties with our allies. This is an interesting area where I think from a foreign policy standpoint, and Vice President Biden has a deep, deep history and experience on foreign policy issues. I think he'll be very interested in looking at that, not just because of his own history on foreign policy matters, but of course, prominently his role as vice president while President Obama was pushing the TPP. And as you noted, the recently signed RCEP. So from a foreign policy standpoint, I think he's not going to be able to avoid the question, how is the United States going to respond? How will they re-engage in the Asia Pacific? And what will the foreign policy be? I don't think that this is just going to be a trade strategy for the Biden administration. Therefore, they may very well start assessing this early on. I expect that there will have to be conversations with members of Congress to assess where members of Congress stand on interest in joining TPP. I expect that there would be broad support. We've heard a lot from progressives in Congress that there would have to be a renegotiation to achieve higher standards on labor and environment. That will not be an easy thing to do.
Sure.
It was not an easy negotiation to begin with because there were so many partners.
Yeah.
A renegotiation would certainly present challenges.
Absolutely.
And then there are logistical challenges as well.
Nassim, I got to jump. Thank you so much for being on. We'll be back with more AgriTalk.
It starts with a plan. That's why America's Conservation Ag Movement is inviting you to get your farm business ready for 2021 with a free Resource Stewardship Planning Guide. Get your free guide today at agweb.com/ACAM.
There are over 2 billion bushels of surplus corn in storage waiting to solve the world's most pressing issues like climate change. Nationwide E15 would generate demand for increasing corn yields. Moving from 10 to 15% ethanol would result in a market of almost 2 billion bushels of new corn demand each year. That's the same as doubling exports, and that's 2 billion reasons to tell your legislators and friends to support ethanol. Learn more about supporting Nationwide E15 at poet.com/ag.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
All right, let's bring in Brian Grady, editor of Pro Farmer, giving us an update on markets. How we stand here? We started out strong on the grain side.
Yeah, the soybean market, Clinton, is really ripping to the upside today. Double-digit gains in those 21 or 20 crop contracts. So Good, strong performance. We have backed off the highs a little bit. The soy oil market has turned to the downside, but meal remains stronger. We didn't get any daily soybean sales today. We did get daily corn sale. It was to Mexico, but that isn't the one that the market's been waiting on. There's been rumors the past several days that China's been in the market for U.S. corn, and we haven't seen that come through in the daily sales yet. So, you know, within the next day or two, we need to see that if that's going to come to fruition. We are seeing bull spreading in both the corn and soybean markets today, an indication that, you know, the front end's driving the market higher and demand driven there. So that is a positive. The wheat market, it's turned lower. It did trade higher at points, but it's under some pressure now, led down by the HRW contracts. And HRW crop condition ratings did improve yesterday in USDA's update.
Yeah, what about on the livestock side of things? Usually they're, you know, a little bit of pressure when grains are trending higher.
Well, it was a quiet day yesterday, like I mentioned, and finished up that way. The cattle market, it's quiet again this morning. Trading with just a slightly firmer tone so far through mid-morning here. The hog market, though, we're seeing moderate to strong gains there, so really working to the upside, and buyer interest is built as we've gone through the morning so far. So we'll see if that continues to build into the close or how that shakes out into the finish here today.
All right. Appreciate it as always. Thank you so much, Brian Grady with Pro Farmer. We'll be back with more AgriTalk in just a minute.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
I'm Andrew McRae, inviting you to join me for Farming the Countryside, a farmer-focused podcast important to agriculture. It is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Visit pivotbio.com to find a representative near you.
Hey, welcome back to AgriTalk. Clinton Griffiths in for Chip Flory today. Next, we've got kind of an interesting conversation and one that we expect to be having a lot of over the next few years. I would expect joining us now, we have Andrew Walmsley. He's the Director of Congressional Relations with the American Farm Bureau Federation. And Andrew, really appreciate you jumping in here on AgriTalk because you just made a big announcement there in D.C. Talk to us what it was and the reason behind it.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me on. We did have a pretty major announcement, and it's in a policy space that you might not expect agriculture to be as comfortable in discussing, and it's been around climate. We launched the Food and Agriculture Climate Alliance, which is a group of organizations that include Farm Bureau, some environmental groups such as Environmental Defense Fund, Nature Conservancy, and then some of our other partners in the food value chain, like the Food Industry Association and National Association of State Departments of Ag and a few others. So basically we're coming together recognizing that farmers have done a lot in this space around climate and sustainability. We know that there's more expected of us, and so we wanted to put a group together that can help drive that conversation, obviously, that we're going to be having in Washington, but also with private sectors and the commitments that we're seeing from a bunch of businesses as well.
Yeah, it is interesting. And there's a coalition of group, like you said, I don't know what to call it, strange bedfellows, but folks that we don't normally team up with on different things. And I find this conversation interesting, Andrew, from a standpoint of, you know, I'm talking with a farmer this morning who's been no-tilling on his farm for 30 years, right? So there's a lot of practices out there in agriculture that we would call sustainable that we've been doing for an awful long time. How does this fit into these conversations, and why is now the right time?
No, you're absolutely correct. I mean, you look at, you know, from a greenhouse gas perspective, American agriculture is, you know, just under 10%, whereas global ag emissions are closer to 25%. You know, why is that? That's because of practices like you described. It's about the innovation that American agriculture has undertaken. You know, we're producing 270% more in roughly two generations while our inputs have remained relatively flat. I mean, that's a huge success story around sustainability that we rarely talk about. So I think the key point is to first recognize what we've done in agriculture, get more comfortable in talking about, you know, the achievements we've made, but recognize that there's going to be additional pressure, you know, societal pressures, Washington, D.C. public policy pressures, and food value chain business pressures. And so if we're not at the table, I know it's a cliche, and Thanksgiving's next week, you know, we're going to be on the menu.
But, you know, really our view at Farm Bureau is we should be setting that table. We should be there. There's things that we can support that can build on the success we've seen in the agriculture sector. And there's obviously things we're going to oppose because we recognize it's going to be harmful for agriculture and our farmers and ranchers. But we at least need to be putting forward policy proposals that work.
Yeah, one of the things that you did also was you rolled out some climate policy recommendations. Can we step through a few of those right now? Walk us through what they are and how you see those coming about in the next administration.
Yeah, so there's about 40 recommendations over 50 pages of recommendations. A couple of overarching things I want to hit on before we hit on any particular policy is the fact that they've got to be voluntary and incentive based. Okay. They've got to be market based. They've got to advance science based outcomes, and you know, recognize that we need to invest in infrastructure in rural communities. You know, your traditional infrastructure that you think about, but also broadband. I mean, we need to be able to do the precision ag, bring extension in the 21st century to our farms and ranches. And at the end of the day, we must do no harm, you know, to either programs, to farmers, or to rural communities. And then when you look at the policy recommendations, they really fall into six different areas: soil health, livestock and dairy, forest and wood products, energy, food loss and waste, and research. So very holistic when you look at the food value chain.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The gentleman that the Biden administration has tapped, or transition team has tapped for a transition, is someone that's worked in this incentive-based environment for sustainability. Seems like there's a lot of momentum on that side of things. You know, one of the bullet points in the press release that went out was to provide voluntary incentive-based tools and additional technical assistance for farmers, ranchers, and foresters to maximize the sequestration of carbon. You know, these incentive-based tools, that seems like an interesting concept, and how do you balance that between public and private?
Yeah, so really we had two viewpoints looking at recommendations. I think there's one track that's probably a little bit more private market-focused that's really for those high-earning, innovative farmers, maybe larger landowners, you know, that want to chase particularly a carbon credit or a carbon tax credit is one of the recommendations. Where you're incentivizing that landowner to sequester or destroy as much carbon as possible, and you know, really chase that value that's out there. And then there's the other track where we're looking at existing programs in NRCS, kind of the public side of it, you know, for some of our smaller landowners or those farmers that say, you know, I'm struggling as it is. I want to do the right thing. Just help me implement a practice here and there along the way so I can be a better steward. And so then we're looking at, you know, some NRCS farm bill type programs that could be tweaked to help implement some climate smart farming practices. So there's really two tracks. There's the big incentive based, you know, innovative side, and then the side that said, hey, I want to do the right thing, help me along, but I'm not going to undermine my business operation, you know, today, because these things have to be tried and tested. We need more research. And that's why, you know, research is a huge component of our recommendations as well.
Yeah. And I know the language here, the verbiage says voluntary versus mandatory. And I think that that seems to be maybe the one that probably catches people's attention the most, right? Is will voluntary be enough? And hopefully it is, right?
Well, it would have to be. I mean, for our farmers and ranchers, you know, carrots always work better than sticks. I mentioned at the beginning, you know, the increase in our outputs, our innovation, the things we've adopted over time. We've done that in a voluntary basis. We've done that incentive-based process. And I think that's the only way you're going to be successful with American agriculture. You know, we're all a little too rebellious to be told what to do from Washington. Mandates, you know, are never welcomed on the farm, but we are looking for partners to work together. You know, we want to be better stewards. We recognize there's more that we can do, and that there's societal benefits that you know, customers, consumers, taxpayers are expecting. We want to work with you to get there, but a mandate typically doesn't play well in rural America.
You know, it is interesting, you know, putting agriculture and environmental groups together seems like that's in the past, they've been at odds with each other. This seems like a new direction of working together.
Absolutely. You know, I have to commend the Environmental Defense Fund, the Nature Conservancy, for wanting to come together and have a dialogue, not to lecture, not to say this is what we should be doing, but to really have meaningful conversation around these issues. And I think that's what is attributed to the success of the launch today, that we were able to come out with
so many recommendations that have real meat on the bones, you know, whether that's for the administration, for Congress. But working together is going to be key in this space. And so, you know, we launched with 8 groups today. We're hoping to add to that. We're inviting other national groups and environmental groups to come and work together with us as we work to implement these practices and implement these policies in the next Congress and the new administration.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, you've put out a survey of folks as well, Farm Bureau did, asking, you know, different questions about sustainability in agriculture. More than half adults, 58%, rate the sustainability practices of farmers as either excellent or good. That seems like a pretty high number. 9 in 10 adults report they trust farmers, which is a 4% increase from June of this year. Agriculture is, and sustainability, and this conversation specifically, has seemed to have gained a little bit of attention, especially given the, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic we've been in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been a tough couple of years in farm country. We've had our challenges. 2020 has been challenging for everyone, you know, but we've still got our members out there still farming, wanting to do the best they can for their families and for the American consumer. And, you know, sustainability, you know, it's helpful. We're glad that the public is recognizing that and that we can be partners in this space. You know, farmers have never shied away from the responsibility that they have. And we're, like I said, hoping to build on that and get farmers and ranchers more comfortable about having these conversations, that it can be a difficult conversation, that there's a lot to be proud of. You know, when you look at Farm Bill and what we've done on conservation practices across this country, there's over 140 million acres that are under conservation. That's more than the states of California and New York combined. Hmm. I mean, so when you really start taking a step back, there's a lot of work that agriculture's done, and we think there's more we can do.
Andrew, what needs to happen next? What can folks at home do? What can they expect to see? What are we watching?
Yeah, you know, today's just the beginning of a journey, right? And so we encourage folks to visit agclimatealliance.com. That's where you can find the recommendations. There's a one-pager, and there's an opportunity to contact us if you have questions. You know, the recommendations will be working, obviously, with lawmakers going forward and through our advocacy efforts. So as we gear up for the 117th Congress, there's going to be opportunities for farmers to get engaged and reach out to their members of Congress, you know, to make sure that any policy proposals that's put forth works for rural America and America's farmers and ranchers.
Andrew, I've got just a couple of minutes. Do you think we get another COVID stimulus package pulled together real quick?
Oh, that's a good question. you know, we've got to figure out how to fund the government past December 11th. You know, there's discussions around a COVID package that doesn't look like we're making a lot of progress. You know, this, the top line numbers are so far apart between the House and Democrats and what the Senate's comfortable doing. So I'm going to give you a Washington answer and run out your time and say, you know, who knows? But there's a lot of work to do in the next, I guess, 13 legislative days we've got in the 116th Congress.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on it. Appreciate it, Andrew. Thank you so much for jumping on here to AgriTalk. We'll be back with more coming up in just a couple of minutes.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Dryshod Waterproof Footwear. It starts with a plan. That's why America's Conservation Ag Movement is inviting you to get your farm business ready for 2021 with a free Resource Stewardship Planning Guide. Get your free guide today at agweb.com/ACAM.
Hey, welcome back as we wrap up another AgriTalk on a Tuesday. Really appreciate you spending some time with us here. We're going to wrap up by talking about a little bit more about the world we live in right now and some of the challenges for folks given what's been going on around the country, around the world with COVID-19. Yesterday, we saw some video that came out of lines of cars waiting to pick up food boxes at a local food bank in Texas, and the caption was record numbers of people waiting for food assistance. And this is not just a problem that we're seeing in one state. This is an issue we're seeing all over the country. And as farmers, our charge, our goal is to ultimately feed people. That is an important cog in society, and it's one that we take a lot of pride in, and I know you take pride in it as well. Here to talk about a project that they've been working on to help make that happen, I'm going to bring in Matt Plitt with Valent USA and Aiden Riley. He's the co-founder of the FarmLink Project. Thank you both for being here. And Matt, I might just start with you on some of the partnerships, some of the things you're working on to try to make those connections to get food to people in this time.
Yeah, it's a great question. Appreciate the opportunity to share some of this. As an organization that's a national-based organization, we really pride ourselves in working back with the local communities with a lot of our corporate social responsibility type projects. We have really aligned with the United Nations and Sustainable Development Goals, and one of those is being zero hunger. So as we were looking across the organization during this pandemic, we said, how can we give back locally? And one of the great opportunities we saw was a partnership with FarmLink, where we could really help with virtual food drives around the country.
Yeah, and Aiden Riley, you're with FarmLink. Talk to us about some of these virtual food drives and what the goal is here and how people can get involved.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, thank you for having me today.
Sure.
And you know, what FarmLink tries to do is, you know, we're an organization of volunteers working from our home to move surplus food from farms to food banks around the country. So the way we do that is by largely cold calling farmers, explaining what we do, establishing a relationship of trust with them, and basically letting them know that we're a resource for them to call if they have a contract / any sort of reason for surplus. We can take it and we can get it to people who need it, and we can get them basically a paycheck to pay their workers or to the PPO costs to get that food out of the ground. So with those virtual food drives, that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah,
we've done it to move 15 million pounds of food since April, and it's what we're going to continue doing in the coming months.
You know, and this is an issue, especially as we start to talk about, you know, more and more states seem to be adding more new restrictions to restaurants and dining services, you know, and a lot of folks, and we've seen, you know, over the last year where all of a sudden that market that they depended on is not there at this time. And it can become a big concern. You harvested this crop, you've got the product. What do you do with it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. Like at Valent USA, you know, we're very focused on sustainable agriculture. And when the food value chain changes and the supply chain throughout that value chain changes, it creates a real hardship for growers in North America. So I think an organization like FarmLink is just ideal for being able to step in, look at some of that that supply concern, and then redirect that to those who really need it.
Aiden, what your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, that was put very well by each of you. And the most extreme example of this, you know, we work with farmers in between April and now. Sometimes in the most extreme cases, we'll see farmers with literally a pile of 5 million pounds of potatoes in their backyard in a shed that was originally allotted to go to someone, and the contract was slashed to this, whatever it may be, and they don't know where to put it, and they're having trouble even dumping it. So that's, you know, the last couple months where we want to come in and we can help them get the right resources to get that box up, get the freight, and get it to the people who actually need it.
Aiden, how do people, if they're interested in being part of your network or part of your group, how do they do that?
Yeah, the best way is to go to our website, farmlinkproject.org. And that way, if you're a food bank and you're interested in getting food, if you're a farmer and you're interested in working with us, there's a tab for that. Or if you're neither, but you want to volunteer our time, we have a whole range of ways you can do that, from volunteering full time to just a couple hours a week through our power hours, where you can help us do research, call farmers, call food banks.
Matt, as you mentioned, you know, this is a mission for Valent. Obviously, it's something that is important to help keep people fed at this time. But, you know, we're all human beings here, right? We're all trying to make sure that we keep, you know, those that are vulnerable in our society well fed and well kept. And this just seems like one of those no-brainer type of things that if people can pitch in, they can help out. Boy, at this time of year, especially around Thanksgiving, it'd be a good idea.
Absolutely. And the way we did it across our organization is we identified several different philanthropic opportunities, and this one really rose to the top. Our employees voted. They said FarmLink is a great fit for what our core values are and what we wanted to give back to our local communities. And through that, not only have we been able to partner with FarmLink, but we've been able to raise nearly $33,000 to contribute to the organization as they look to expand their presence and help others out there in need.
Well, I appreciate you both for being here. Thank you for what you're doing, not just for agriculture, but for folks around the country trying to do the good work of getting food to people so it doesn't go to waste. Really appreciate that. And hopefully folks out there can find you at the FarmLink Project so they can get involved if they'd like to. Again, really appreciate you being on AgriTalk today.
Thank you very much.
Yep, absolutely. And thank all of you for tuning in today. Obviously, just a jam-packed show. We covered a lot of ground, talked everything from what's going on with dairy, and we've got dairy margin coverage program signups that are due. We've covered trade. We talked about the phase one deal. We talked about the future of trade in the next 4 years. One of the things that is going to be on everybody's mind over the next week is just this whole idea of Thanksgiving and how do we work our way through 2020 with a heart of Thanksgiving. And I think that's something to reflect on. Hopefully everybody takes a few minutes as they wrap up harvest, they put the machinery away, they start to plan for next year is, you know, what lessons did we learn this year? What's in our hearts and how can we push forward into 2021? It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. Have a great day. Bye.
Thanks to Acuron Corn Herbicide for sponsoring the AgriTalk podcast. Talk to your retailer about how you can get 5 to 15 more bushels with Acuron. Acuron is a restricted-use pesticide. Acuron Yield Advantage range is based on 2016 Syngenta and University trials.